Welcome to the Future of Media podcast, brought to you by Native, the market's most advanced social media management solution. Don't let legacy tools hold you back from your team's growth. Learn about the next generation of social optimization at native.com. That's N-A-Y-T-E-V.com. We hope you enjoy this week's episode of the Future of Media.
Hey everyone, this is Patrick with the Native team, bringing you the Future of Media podcast today, and we're speaking with Patrick Courtney at Fuse Media. Thanks for joining us today, Patrick.
Thank you for having me, Patrick.
This transcript is going to be very confusing. It's going to be two Patrick.
Yeah, you're telling me.
Well, could you kick things off by sharing a little bit about yourself and your professional experience and current focus?
Sure. So I am currently the SVP of Digital Strategy and Operations for Fuse Media, which is a cable network. We consider ourselves a multi-platform entertainment company, but people most know us as a cable channel. My background is in audience development and digital marketing for most of my career. I got my start in agency world, doing sort of digital outreach type stuff for movie studios, getting placements for movie titles on different blogs and sites back when that was a big deal for Discovery. Also, we're doing some of the first user-generated video campaigns. We did an interesting user-generated campaign for Dave Chappelle's Block Party back in the day, which was fun. So those are early days of user-generated video. And then I've been in the publishing world. I worked for Forbes.com for a time doing audience development for their video network when video on sites was growing and becoming more of an emphasis for publishers. Then bounced around a little bit to agencies, doing word-of-mouth marketing campaigns. We're building fan communities before social. We eventually kind of evolved the agency that I worked for into a social media agency as, you know, custom fan communities went by the wayside as social took that share. And then prior to Fuse, I worked for a company called Above Average, which was Lorne Michaels' digital comedy network, running audience development, marketing, and for a period of that, also the content programming. So Above Average had a YouTube channel. We were making a lot of short-form sketch videos and content for audiences and selling against them, selling branded content campaigns. And building audiences on that. And then I joined Fuse about a couple of years ago now. And my responsibility here, my scope is basically everything nonlinear. So we have our cable network business, and then there's everything else that we consider digital here. That runs the gamut from working with the content studio team that's making content for digital platforms. So the production side of that, the distribution of that content, as well as our linear library in nonlinear platforms, our O&Os, apps, AVODs, and SVODs, international, and then the overall monetization. So we can look at nonlinear as a different type of a business, and how do we build our top line revenues for the nonlinear side of the business as we, you know, continue to manage the decline of cable overall.
Can you share an overview of Fuse's target audience and whether or not that differs between the linear and nonlinear side?
Fortunately for us, we are a youth-centric network, so we have one of the lowest median ages in TV, you know, relative to digital. It's still an older audience, considering I think the median age for cable overall is something like 50. Our audience we dub as multicultural millennials, but it's basically young people interested in fresh, relevant content related to music culture. So as music taps into or becomes more of an influence across a lot of different areas of lifestyle, from food to fashion and streetwear to entrepreneurship, we tackle that space. So we put music on top of an overall lifestyle brand and appeals to a younger audience, 18 to 34. They watch content obviously across all screens and devices, and so it's in priority for us to be in those areas. And that's where my group is responsible for trying to reach them as they span pay TV to digital and social environments.
Among all the distribution channels that you're focused on to reach that younger audience, which ones are most valuable, and has that evolved much in the last couple of years?
Yes, it has evolved quite a bit over the last couple of years. And that's in part why I came to Fuse, was to help figure out what that looks like and how we build on that. What's most valuable is what our audience finds most valuable. You know, we have various areas of our business that are more, you know, economically favorable to us. But it's important as a youth-centric entertainment company, multi-platform entertainment company, that we are where our audience is and where they want to watch content and when they want to watch that content. So that's why we consider ourselves a multi-platform entertainment company. Our audience watches a lot of TV, traditional cable TV, even though there's a lot of conversation about it being in decline, it's still a huge platform and our audience watches a lot of content there. So we're very much invested in delivering a great content experience on linear. But we also know that they spend a lot of time on mobile devices, spend a lot of time streaming. And so we have content strategies and distribution strategies that suit those behaviors also.
What's that relative balance look like between mobile versus traditional TV? And obviously you've got second screen behavior complicating matters. Maybe they're watching you on TV directly while also navigating your site at the same time on their phone. But what does that look like?
The idea of the second screen experience is pretty common now. I think most people probably do that to some degree. It's an attention deficit climate and generation, and I think that is continuing. You know, we program content for not only various screens, whether they're sitting down on their couch and watching television, but also if they're on their commute to work or, you know, going between classes at college. We program content for those environments too. And it's a very different approach to content. The way you make a TV show is very different than how you make a 3-minute video for YouTube, both in terms of what that content should be, what people want to watch with that time that they have, as well as, you know, the production of that. So, you know, we take a different approach to every type of need state our audience has with regard to how we deliver content.
You briefly mentioned the trend for people to not necessarily watch content on TV like they might have in the past. Obviously, a lot of buzz around cord cutting and the rise of digital streaming services like Hulu and Netflix. What are the biggest differences in terms of barriers to entry and revenue potential between licensing content to traditional TV networks and streaming services?
I think that people will pay for good content. If they care about the content that they want to watch, they will pay for the content that they want to watch. You know, we look at it from that standpoint. It's how do we become sort of an indispensable entertainment brand on the various properties that we're on, and then, you know, leverage the economics to the best that we can on those platforms. With pay TV, for example, you know, people come to Fuse because we have original programming that they can't find anywhere else. One of our shows, back to the idea of music culture through the lens of, say, entrepreneurship, we have a show with T-Pain, who's really having a moment right now, having won the Masked Singer and is now hosting the iHeart Awards and just dropped an album. But we have a show with him that he basically goes around to various startups and that are interesting and unique and have passionate founders. And he, you know, is very interested in that space and thinks about, you know, how they're building their businesses and really understanding people's passions and behaviors. And that's exclusively available on our pay TV offering. We have a windowing strategy. So after a certain period of time, then we'll take a look and talk to a Hulu or a Netflix about a second window in an SVOD environment where we can continue to monetize that content after the life through pay TV. I think what's different really as far as like those economics is the currency that it trades on. Traditional TV trades on ratings. It's pretty endemic to the cable business. And the streamers tend to trade more on, you know, performance or projected performance, or I should say they take more of an interest in how that show will do for them based on the data they have. And then they take a look at, you know, what they might be willing to spend on that. They have a fairly analytical approach, at least from our experience, as far as you know, what they choose, how much they pay for that, what that looks like. But, you know, for us, there's still, you know, a significant amount of money in TV. It's a huge business. Even as people, you know, do the cord shaving thing, a lot of them are moving to skinny bundles or to digital IPTVs, vMVPD type things. There's still a ton of opportunity there, and we're happy to be in that business.
Do you think there'll be more emphasis on the type of performance metrics that streaming platforms are doing, in terms of how traditional networks consider what to invest in?
Yeah, I think so. There's always that argument with content is the art and science conversation. I think that, you know, how you strike that balance depends on the platform and how much power that platform gives to an algorithm, right? How much it trusts the system to recommend that content, and how much is dependent on things like metadata and search cluster information and things like that. We tend to take a data-informed position versus being data-driven. So it helps support the process. It guides it in the right direction. But creatively, you still need to take bets. You need to take risks in order to stay relevant. And that's true whether you're a programmer like Fuse or you're a platform like a Netflix.
That ties in perfectly with my next question. About a year ago, Fuse launched three different divisions to create content that better connects with target audiences. And your executive vice president, Jason Miller, noted that data and analytics are at the core of fueling all this content. What do you think is the right balance to strike between analytics and experimentation?
We're a lot more data informed than we used to be. The tools that are available have gotten more sophisticated across all of our content production, whether it's a linear property, a linear series, or it's a short form video. But we take a look at, you know, the subject matter of the content, the talent, the format. We run a lot of that through our own analysis to understand, you know, is this the right show with the right talent done the right way that would set it up for success? We take all of the things that we're looking at, all of the different trends of what is successful, and then try to develop something to take advantage of that. We start with the creative first. But a little bit is also platform dependent. Again, with linear, you know, you're looking at ratings, you're looking at driving larger audiences to tune in appointment viewing TV. That can be a different creative process than, you know, trying to take advantage of the YouTube algorithm, getting a video from 0 to 20 million views or something like that, because it needs to be something in a familiar format, like a challenge video or reaction video or something that's endemic to that platform. So we have varied approaches depending on the content, but overall we take a creative first approach with a data informed perspective.
On the data side, to what extent are you able to use audience engagement data that you're picking up from YouTube, Facebook, other social channels, or even website interactions? Can you use that information to better inform future content investments?
I think it definitely does. We see things in the content itself, right? Like how long someone watches for, where they drop off, how many episodes they consume at a time, how they found the content, what were they searching for, the discovery patterns. That all helps us understand why they might be watching our content. That's all really helpful. And then, you know, back to the conversation about a windowing strategy. As we put our content into other platforms that are non-linear, we will often see different viewership habits there. We might see that a series outperforms in a streaming environment where maybe it didn't quite perform as well on linear. We'll take that into consideration as we look at a renewal to understand whether or not, you know, there is an audience for this that we weren't able to tap into during the first window, but we're able to cultivate that and build something for a season two.
Moving back to some of the challenges that have come up in terms of moving from non-linear and linear and back and forth for folks, You see a lot of media companies from Vox to Vice, BuzzFeed, and Complex trying to license shows to streaming services. What are the biggest barriers facing these new entrants?
You have to ask Vox, Vice, and BuzzFeed to get that answer. I'd say you have to have something of value, and that sounds fairly simple, but that's not easy to create something that people want. It's expensive. Making good content is not cheap. It can be time consuming. Building an audience around IP that you're developing can take a lot of time, and it's not guaranteed. You're not for sure going to be successful. And then on the other side of it, performance is not universal. What works on one platform might not work on another. If you have a successful YouTube series, that doesn't mean it's going to be a hit on linear. It doesn't mean that it's going to be a hit in FBOD. Creating value and then maximizing that value across platforms is a challenging thing to do.
Do you think that these new entrants might have any extra edge to outperform standard rates of show success, given that they touch so many folks in the digital realm with their websites and reach on social?
Like, brand doesn't necessarily translate across platforms. So it's not important necessarily to have a large audience. But you need to have an engaged audience that you're able to mobilize, that they need to be able to recognize you and trust that you're going to deliver a great content experience anywhere you engage with them. So I think, some of the digital media companies have enormous scale, but they don't necessarily have the ability to take that scale and move it across screens and devices. But there's a lot of brand value that has to be built that can be sometimes challenging to do, especially if it's in a space that there isn't a ton of history or experience in doing. So, you have to think about that, and then you have to think about where the audience that you do have, where they are spending their time, and then, figure out a way to offer value there. So if your audience is on TV, if they're on Netflix, if they're on Pluto, if they're on YouTube, where does your audience go and for what reasons? And understanding that very intimately, and then having a strong enough brand that you can enter into those spaces and deliver that audience, I think is what's important.
Having that engaged audience makes a lot of sense and relates to my next question around the massive volume of new content that seems to be available now through streaming services. They have a lot of great content, but they also have an enormous volume of what seems to be low quality content. And a while back, there was a really apt description on the Reddit forum, Shower Thoughts, that stated, Netflix is like a refrigerator full of food with nothing I want to eat. What do you think of the drivers are behind this phenomenon, and does it relate at all to the way in which streaming services are licensing or paying for content?
I think that sounds more like choice paralysis than necessarily low quality content. Everybody has that problem, and it's often because you don't know how to decide. I think choice paralysis is a real thing. I think there's a couple things going on. You've got more capital flowing into content creation than there's ever been. There's just a lot of content being made. People call that the content arms race, because they're all trying to create their own original library offering to be able to continue to drive pricing power and get people to stay subscribed to their services. And then there's more sophisticated methods of search and discovery. So these platforms like a Netflix is like, notoriously focused on how people discover content on their platform, how the algorithm works to drive related content. There's a lot of discussion about how they do that with like very strange search clusters or subject matter pairings, and how people's interests translate across different areas of content. But I think this provides an environment for you to be able to take more bets, and then the algorithm filters out what people want to watch, what people consider to be good or not good, and present that to you. And when you're that well capitalized, there's a lot of bets that don't pay off, and that's not necessarily a concern as long as some of them do. And I think that's maybe what people might be referring to when they say that there's a lot of quote unquote junk on the platform, it's just that there's just a lot of content. And some of that content has very specific audiences with niche interests. And there's just a lot of content being populated on those platforms. I get it. I get the analogy about the refrigerator full of food. But I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
Follow on to that, the second top comment was, Netflix is a refrigerator full of so many foods I've never tried, but I let them rot and eat leftover pizza I've had a million times before instead. Even if you have more capital for experimentation and can go after very targeted audiences, does it even make sense to experiment much? Is it a better bet to just stick with tried and true, maybe just a repackaged version of the archetypal hero's journey?
I think the leftover pizza analogy is like Friends or The Office, right? That's what Netflix paid $100 million for, to have Friends for a year, not exclusively because of that. Because I think there's a little bit of, and I don't mean this like in a negative way, but there's like a little bit of a laziness when it comes to entertainment. People want to be entertained, but they don't want to really work. There's a familiarity is a very strong motivator. I think that's important, but that doesn't drive interest in the long term. You've got to continue to push boundaries and take risks and have something fresh and interesting to keep people keep people subscribed, to keep people watching and tuning in. You need to continue to push boundaries to stay relevant, so you can eventually get to a place where you can make another Friends or The Office.
Yeah, makes sense. So cater to some aspect of familiarity, power through choice paralysis and any particular laziness, and always be pushing the boundaries in a balanced way.
Yes.
Switching gears a bit, which linear and non-linear entertainment trends are you most worried about or most excited about?
Well, let's start with what's most exciting to me is choice, right? Like we feel that Fuse is a strong brand, has a very specific point of view when it comes to music culture. We think the type of entertainment that we provide our audience resonates. We see that with the engagement that we get on that content. This new evolution of the entertainment ecosystem is a good thing for brands like that, that stand for something, that are specific, that people care about. That's very exciting, because now people have a lot of choice and they can get their content in any number of places. And if you have a strong enough brand, that's advantageous to you. What scares me a little bit is that there is so much capital going into content at the moment. And these businesses, Netflix and Hulu, for example, aren't profitable. I have concerns that audiences are spoiled a little bit. They're not paying enough for the amount of content and entertainment that's being delivered to them at the moment. That's why, Netflix keeps, incrementally ticking up that price, because at a certain point they can make a profit. Difficult for legacy business models that, charge an appropriate amount. You can argue what's appropriate there. That content should command. And so you start to almost commoditized content, which isn't a great thing. Now that said, there's an unlimited amount of amazing stuff that's out there, and that's very exciting. There's never any shortage of things to watch or be entertained by. But then you wonder, how do you get consumers to realize that content experience? There's a cost to that, and right now they're kind of getting it at a discount, and that will eventually change. I think that has to evolve over time, but that's why I put some pressure on legacy companies and business models.
You obviously have incredible experience on the digital broadcasting side, but I know that you also have some entrepreneurial experience at the company Nearly Newlywed. Could you introduce Nearly Newlywed and share a little bit about your work there?
Yeah. I helped my wife start a pre-owned wedding dress business about 7 years ago or so. We got married. She wanted to wear this $8,000 Vera Wang wedding dress. She didn't want to pay $8,000 for it, for a dress she was going to wear for a few hours. So she found it pre-owned online. This is a crazy story, but like her and her mother flew down to Atlanta to see the dress. You're talking about, you know, potential savings of thousands of dollars flying to Atlanta. Actually, you know, isn't that crazy of an idea, but they flew down there to make sure that it was real and it was authentic and it was, you know, fit and all that stuff. And then she bought it. She bought it for $3,500 or something like that. She wore it for her wedding. She was beautiful. It was amazing. And then she resold it to another bride and ended up, you know, spending net about $500 for an $8,000 gown. So that whole experience helped her, you know, get to the conclusion that this would potentially be a good business. So she started Nearly Newlywed, the peer-to-peer pre-owned wedding dress marketplace. We're now expanding into new products and accessories and gifts and all that stuff. Everything, basically, the place to buy and sell your wedding. And we were very lucky early to be on Shark Tank, so that helped. That helped quite a bit with exposure and visibility very early on. And so it's been really fun to watch her business grow. And I moonlight on nights and weekends when our 2.5-year-old son Ryan is sleeping or taking a nap on the overall marketing and business strategy side of things.
Are there many lessons that you've learned from that side that can apply over to your work in digital broadcasting or vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fundamentals of digital marketing and reaching audiences and delivering, whether it's entertainment or it's commerce opportunities and calls to action in those environments is something that I've spent my entire career doing. And there's a lot of parallels, you know, between how you get somebody to watch something, how you get somebody to buy something. There are very different behaviors, but I think one thing that's interesting is there's kind of like a convergence that's happening there a little bit now, where there's this idea of shoppable video. You're seeing a lot of commerce companies investing a lot more in video, enriching their video with metadata that could allow that content to become shoppable. You look at like Amazon, anybody with Amazon Prime, you watch content and you pause that content and it pulls up all that metadata from IMDb about who's in the scene. You can imagine where that goes when they start to integrate product information. That is very interesting to me. I think that's pretty cool. I've seen a few startups doing some things in that space to capitalize on that. I think it seems like it's still a little ways away yet, but it seems like it's kind of a natural fit for people. I mean, I think the TVs is one thing, especially with voice, but also on mobile, when you're watching a piece of content, like you can be interacting with that content in a way that is promotes commerce in a certain capacity. And so I think that's great. And for Nearly Newlywed, we haven't really invested in video to this point yet, partly because we're a pretty small operation. But we talk about that a lot. We talk about how, you know, if there were video of this wedding dress, of somebody wearing that wedding dress and watching how it flows and, you know, in different environments, how much more value that would add to the consumer who's considering purchasing that item is really interesting. So that's kind of where some of that crosses over. And that seems like a pretty exciting space.
Is the onus on TV broadcasters or streaming systems to try and come up with that interconnect between e-commerce and the viewing experience? Or is this something you think new tech providers will need to come in and fill that role?
Look, I think that's a good question. I think it seems like now you've got the big tech giants who will eat up anything that looks promising, so that there probably will be some of that goes on. You'll find innovation in smaller startups and organizations who are super focused on one thing and have a promising technology, and then it gets bought out by one of those players. For Amazon, it's a no-brainer. You know, their entertainment business is almost like, you know, a marketing platform for their commerce business. For digital media publishers who are trying to diversify their revenue streams, they're taking a lot of the initiative to try to drive new ways of earning revenue, and commerce is a very natural area for that. Whether that's affiliate or it's the manufacturing of new products based on the interest that they're seeing, the data that they get from their audiences, that's a really interesting thing that's going on. I think BuzzFeed was just in the news talking a little bit about some of the stuff that they're doing with that. which I think is pretty cool with video content. Like the way that that really ultimately works is with a very rich set of metadata for your content that these platforms can read and contextualize and figure out ways to map that to other ways of delivering information or value, and whether that's, you know, actor information on screen or product information that's available in that content that you can buy, kind of coming from all sides and everybody's figuring that out together. I don't think that anybody really necessarily drives it. There's economic interest in e-commerce from the big platforms and for the publishers, digital media publishers in general, who are getting a little more pressure to show profitability, show revenue growth. It's a natural area for them to explore.
Yeah, it seems like there needs to be some more walking before folks run. It's pretty nascent even for folks like Pinterest or Instagram to even be adding taggable shop links to images, let alone trying to make it work great as a user experience on a full video side. And as we've seen with a lot of midstream ads on video, they're not particularly compelling, haven't quite panned out the right user experience. Have you seen any examples in the wild where you think folks have done this well, whether with images or video?
I think what's happening in Instagram stories is interesting. Instagram in general, I think, is doing some interesting things with shoppable ad units. Nearly Newlywed uses that. So we have our product feed plugged into our Instagram account on Nearly Newlywed, and we tag our products, and that shows information that they can get with a tap before they decide to make the jump and go buy that product or to do it within the interface of Instagram. We're not seeing that as a revenue driver for us at the moment. And that's in part because we're selling a wedding dress. So somebody who's going to buy a $2,000 or $3,000 wedding dress in an Instagram feed with one click, the individual is either very rich or crazy. But what it does do is it puts them in the mindset of shopping. Like, oh, this is interesting. Like, I'm going to learn a little bit more about this product. I might make the jump and I might learn a little bit more about it. And then later, after I've considered that for a while, I'll come back and buy that product. So for us, it's like one more level deep than just like showing a picture of a dress. We can add a little bit more of that information, that metadata into it, a taste of what that is, what that looks like, the price, a couple of details about that product that might spark their interest a little more than just a static image could with a caption. For us, that's pretty interesting. We're now getting into gifts and things that are a little more accessible for social impulse, like impulse line checkout, e-commerce behavior. So selling like t-shirts and mugs and that stuff. And, you could just tap that and buy that. And we're seeing some of that behavior.
I really appreciate you diving into the examples that you've seen working well for Nearly Newlywed on Instagram. It certainly sounds really promising, even if it's just starting to ramp up brand awareness and getting people in the right mindset. What other social channels do you think are doing well with video commerce rate, whether for Nearly Newlywed or tying in with the efforts that your team at Fuse might be doing?
With our show, T-Pain School of Business, showcasing interesting products and ventures from entrepreneurs, you can see that's a fairly good fit. It's not really so much from a technology standpoint, like being able to buy, that product necessarily within the video content itself, but surrounding that content with information about where and how to buy that thing. That's something we're working on. We're in production actually on season 2, so we're excited about what we're going to be able to do with that. We're starting to think about our YouTube channel now that YouTube's getting a little bit more in that space. We've got like merchandising shelves on channels that you can access. And so we're thinking about how we can do that, because we often have artists who come through our office and shoot repeatable type format. We have a show where artists do ASMR, sensory meridian response, gives you the tingles when you listen to somebody like whisper or crinkle a piece of paper. So we have artists do that. So we'll have like Wiz Khalifa do that. They often have their own lines of products or service or whatever it is that they're trying to promote, or an album or something like that. So we're looking at ways that we can start to maybe offer some opportunities for commerce within those experiences. So yeah, we're giving it a lot of thought. But as you said before, like a lot of this is still nascent. It's hard to really go all in on something. You have to start to explore it and take a few bets here and there, dip your toe into the water a little bit. So we'll see where things go this year, but there's some exciting things that we're working on.
I'm really excited to see all that come out.
Cool.
Patrick, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Patrick. This is fun.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have any additional questions, please feel free to go to our website, www.native.com, which is www.naytev.com, to access any of our case studies or ask us any of your questions directly.